Welcome to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in Central Iowa. I'm your host for the show, Greta Anderson. Today's broadcast is a lecture given by Winona Hotter, Executive Director of the Food and Water Watch, and author of a new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Ms. Hotter spoke at the ISU campus on October 22nd as part of the third annual Food Day, sponsored by the ISU Sustainable Agriculture Student Association. So, without further ado, here is Winona Hotter.
So, when I was 11, my parents, who were missionaries, decided that it was time to get back to the farm. My dad had grown up in the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, and he still had some romantic ideas about farming, and he actually had been an early subscriber to the Rodale Press's organic gardening. So my parents didn't have much money, but they put together their resources and bought a really funky farm outside of Washington, D.C., about 45 miles away. Now, in those days, D.C. was a sleepy little town, a very small population, and it was like being really out in the country. And our driveway was a mile long. We had almost knee-deep ruts in the driveway and needed a dump truck to get in and out. I don't think my father had really thought about that. And my dad wasn't much into creature comforts, so he never bothered to put the central heat in this old farmhouse that nobody had lived in for decades, and never bothered to put the plumbing in. I was an only child. It was my job to chop kindling. I plucked chickens, squeezed potato bugs, and I can tell you, I could not wait to get away from that farm when I was 18 years old. But I think I learned a lot of my most valuable lessons in growing up on a farm, and a lot of the values that I have today come from that time. And I'm very lucky. I'm an only child who inherited a 100-acre farm 45 miles outside of Washington, D.C., that my husband retired about 15 years ago to run a community-supported agriculture program because we have a very large population today. Now, one of the reasons that I wrote Foodopoly, and there are a number of reasons that I'll mention tonight, but it's the whole idea that farmers are somehow going to start doing direct sales and, just give up the big tractors and start growing vegetables. And I've been speaking in classes all day, and I've said several times, I think it's going to be really hard in Iowa to compete with California in growing vegetables. And I don't see where the infrastructure, the tractors, and all of the equipment is going to come from. So I think we better have some farm policies that really make it possible for us to transition the kind of agriculture that we do so that farmers can make a living and so that we have a healthy food system. So tonight, I want to talk about some farm policy history that I think it's really important that anybody who's interested in agriculture, that's doing any aspect of agriculture at university, actually knows about. And I don't think a lot of this history is actually taught in school anymore. Because, you know, if we need to know where we're going right, we kind of need to know where we've been. So I'm going to start before World War II. And many of you will remember that we were in a real economic crisis in the 1920s in this country. And so when the Roosevelt administration came into office in the early 1930s, one of the things that they were trying to do was to improve life, not just in urban areas for workers, but to actually improve the economic conditions in rural areas. And at that time, 54% of the population lived on farms. And you have to remember that the first 5 years of the 1930s, we lost 1/6 of all farms at that time, but we still had about 6.8 million farms. So what I want to talk about tonight is what happened in the Roosevelt administration that really helped agriculture, and how over the past several decades, those policies have been eliminated, really hurting agriculture, the farmers' ability to make a living, and, you know, created a food system that is both making people sick and overweight. So what the Roosevelt administration decided to do was to create some policies that would actually make it possible for farmers to make a living. And most of you probably know that the Secretary of Agriculture during the first two Roosevelt terms came from Iowa. His name was Henry Wallace, and he knew a lot about agriculture and knew a lot of the things that needed to be done. Now, the problem for farmers has always been, and continues to be today, actually making the cost of production and then making a profit on top of the cost of production. So the Roosevelt administration came up with a number of common sense policies that made it possible for agriculture to thrive, rural communities to thrive, and for food to be a reasonable price and for consumers to have access to a healthy food system. They did things like create programs that were a price floor, created a price floor for farmers so that the farmers could actually get back the cost of production. And they did this through some wonky things that we're not going to go into tonight, but involved having a grain reserve. You know, China's had a grain reserve since 54 AD. The grain reserve was actually filled during good years. There was a loan program. Farmers could take out loans. And then if the companies that were buying the grains didn't pay a decent price, they could sell their grain to the government and store it on their farms on a grain reserve, which served to actually dramatically stabilize prices, something that hadn't happened. It was a supply management tool. There were other programs that helped manage supply so that the price of agricultural products for farmers was something that actually allowed them to have what was called parity with urban workers, or they were paid on par with urban workers. You know, it's kind of like a living wage for farmers. Millions of acres of marginal land were taken out of production at this time, land that shouldn't have had crops being grown on it, and a number of other programs. It's worth going back if you're an ag student and looking at some of these Depression-era farm programs, which I think would benefit agriculture today if we reestablished some of these supply mechanisms. So things worked pretty well during World War II, and probably all of you know from your history lessons that during World War II, the U.S. provided food really for all of the Allies as Europe was being devastated. And after the war, when Europe was really in a shambles and a lot of the colonial governments around the world were falling because of the changes that had taken place during the war, the U.S. was still providing food at a reasonable price. And at that time, rural communities were pretty much thriving. Farmers were growing food. Young men were coming back from World War II and taking over their family farms. And things were working pretty well. But not everybody was very happy with the situation with young men coming back from the war, going back into agriculture, because a lot of things had really changed during the war. And these are all things we know and have read about. The U.S. had become an industrial powerhouse, a manufacturing powerhouse. The center of finance had moved to New York. And the U.S. was really beginning to change. And there were a group of industrial leaders who believed that agriculture was the old way, that it was bad public policy to have all of these small farms, and that there needed to be major changes that actually drove young men out of rural communities into urban areas to provide the labor for the growing industries, especially in the northern United States. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is some kind of really weird, wild conspiracy. I'm saying that this is business leaders who get together in their clubs, who talk in the different interlocking directorships for different companies, who socialize together. There was just a feeling that there needed to be a lot more labor and, you know, cheap labor, to be honest, when you go back and read those documents from the past. Now, one of the organizations that was formed at this time to lobby to really increase the size of farms and to drive agriculture and food processing more towards vertical integration, one of these organizations is very interesting, and you can actually find some of their reports on the internet today. It's called the Committee for Economic Development. And a number of very influential people got together to put this organization into operation. One of them was a man by the name of Paul Hoffman, who was the president of Studebaker, one of the largest car firms of the time. Another's name was Marion Folsom. He was an executive at Kodak Eastman. Another of the individuals was named William Hoffman. He was on the cutting edge of consumer research and how advertising can actually change people's minds. And these were the three initial organizers of this Committee for Economic Development. And they believed that there was what they called excess labor in farming, and that these New Deal policies, these 1930s policies that were allowing small diversified farms to thrive, were really old-fashioned, that the country really needed to get rid of these New Deal programs. And they set about putting together a strategy for doing this. It's kind of interesting. This organization, in the first 15 years of its existence, 38 of its members held public office. Two of its members were Federal Reserve Bank chairs. And these were very influential and high-placed individuals. Now, they began to be able to chip away at these New Deal policies under the Eisenhower administration. There was an individual who was Secretary of Agriculture during part of the Eisenhower administration named Ezra Benson. Now, Ezra Benson was an ideologue, and he believed that these New Deal policies were driving the country towards communism. Don't laugh, it's the truth. You'll remember that this was the period in U.S. history when the McCarthy hearings were going on and there was a lot of concern about communism. Now, I don't know if he really believed that or not, but he was very aligned with the largest agribusinesses and food processors. And so he began to use his position to chip away a bit at those parity programs that let farmers make a living on par with urban workers. And meanwhile, the Committee for Economic Development and a lot of the other actors in society who wanted to get rid of these New Deal programs were organizing and using their influence. And by the early 1960s, the Committee for Economic Development had become a very large and influential organization. And in 1962, and they had been able to attract most of the titans of industry, most of the big publishing houses, the economics departments of the most prestigious universities in the country. And they put out a report called An Adaptive Plan for Agriculture. And the whole mission of this report was to make the case that the New Deal farm programs, the grain reserve, and all of the other policies really didn't make economic sense, weren't efficient. That's when we started to hear efficiency a lot in the economics departments. And the 18 economics departments actually helped write that report. And I actually got a copy of it on the internet. Now, going to move ahead to the 1970s, because that's when a lot of the really dramatic changes began to happen, although we did lose half of all farms between 1950 and 1970, before the real agricultural crisis began in the 1970s. Now, I want to mention a number of things that happened under the Nixon administration, and I want to say up front that I'm going to pick on both political parties tonight, even though I'm starting with Richard Nixon, because really there's been total agreement on a lot of these issues between both parties. But under Richard Nixon, one of Ezra Benson's proteges became Secretary of Agriculture. And most of you are too young to remember Earl Butz. I see people kind of smiling, because anybody who knows about him kind of smiles, because he was such a character. I remember him because, of course, in the 1970s, we had, depending on where you lived, 4 or 5 TV channels, right? And at dinner time, lots of families sat down and watched the evening news while they were eating dinner. And Earl Butz would often be on the evening news because he had a really big ego. Everybody knew who the Secretary of Agriculture was in those days. And he used his position to tell farmers that they needed to adapt or get out. They needed to get big or get out. They needed to borrow a lot of money and buy a lot of land and equipment, or rent a lot of land, because the U.S. was going to become the grain-producing capital of the world. Well, there was only one year during the 1970s that the U.S. had an export market for grain, and that was the year that Earl Butz arranged it for President Nixon's election against George McGovern. And so taking the lead of Cargill, ADM, and some of the other grain traders, a big deal was put together with the Soviet Union, which was slightly illegal at the time. The Soviet Union had had a big grain failure, and a very large percentage of U.S. grain went to the Soviet Union that year. Made about $2 billion for the grain traders, which was a lot of money in those days. And the next year, the price of bread went up. But by that time, Richard Nixon had been reelected. Now, there was no grain market for the rest of the 70s, even though farmers did start borrowing a lot of money, often using the farm as collateral, buying lots of equipment, you know, listening to the USDA and the experts about the direction to go. And what happens when there's no market for your grain and you've borrowed a lot of money and you've put your farm up as collateral? Well, eventually you lose your farm. And that was really the beginning of the very painful and dramatic agricultural crisis that I know some of your families and some of you probably lived through in the 1970s and going into the 1980s. Now, a number of other things had also begun to change in the 1970s. There was a lot of pressure to allow companies to get bigger, much, much larger. And the excuse of the day was, well, we have to compete with Japan. It was Japan in those days. And to be competitive, we really need our corporations to be able to get very large. And there was also a lot of pushback about the social and cultural and political changes that had taken place in the 1960s that were not just cultural, but a lot of our major environmental laws were actually passed in the early 1970s under the Nixon administration. And there was a lot of pushback from a lot of the industries that were being regulated by these new laws, and a real desire to kind of take back the regulatory system. So one of the things that Richard Nixon did that I think had a big impact on even society today is he appointed to the Supreme Court an individual named Lewis Powell. Now, Lewis Powell was a corporate lawyer, and he was on the board of about 11 different corporations. And he was a perceptive and strategic thinker. And 2 months before he was nominated to be a Supreme Court justice, he wrote a memo to one of his friends who was in the leadership of the Chamber of Commerce, one of the most influential political organizations in this country. And he said that it was time for industry, and not just the food industry, he was talking about all industry, to fight back against all of this regulation and the political and social and cultural changes that had taken place. It was time for them to organize their money, get involved in universities, take back universities, take back the political system by giving money, campaign contributions, create their own infrastructure that would write reports, do media work, that would talk about all of the problems of regulation and would really promote the economic interests of corporations. And this memo came to light after about 15 or 20 years. And you can go to the internet today, and I would encourage anybody who's not familiar with this memo to Google Powell memo and read about, you know, really the strategic thinking about how to create a political system that I would say has kind of hijacked our democracy. And what happened as a result of this is that a number of very wealthy people and large corporations did get together and begin pooling their money and raising money, and their candidate was Ronald Reagan.
You are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. This lecture, given by Winona Hauter, was part of the third annual Food Day sponsored by the ISU Sustainable Agricultural Student Association. Food Day is these students' counterpart to the World Food Prize, which this year went to Monsanto, a corporation that controls an estimated 90% of soybeans grown in the U.S. and Latin America. In the next part of her lecture, Winona Hauter discusses the corporate monopolies that control several different levels of the food system.
They weren't just interested in kind of the deregulation that we usually think of, environmental deregulation. Top on their agenda was getting rid of the nation's antitrust laws. Now, I think it's important that we all recognize that there has been in our nation a debate about who should have the power in society since this nation was founded. This was a debate between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, and Thomas Jefferson won that round. And we've seen over the course of the nation's history a real debate and discussion about how large economic interests should be allowed to get. And we all know about the trust busting of the Teddy Roosevelt era. And I mean, this has been a continuing debate. So the modern piece of this debate, and actually the evisceration of antitrust laws, began under the Reagan administration. It was finished under the Clinton administration. But let me start with what happened in 1981. So after President Reagan was elected, what you would expect happened. If you want to get rid of antitrust laws, that means that you have to impact the agencies that oversee these laws. And several agencies are involved, but the two most important are the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice. Now, in writing Foodopoly, I actually had the pleasure of talking to one of the commissioners from the Federal Trade Commission at this time. His name's Michael Perchuk, and he's actually retired in the Southwest. And he told me about a document that I should read. It was a 400-page report to Congress that he and a colleague, he had been a Jimmy Carter appointee, but his colleague was a Nixon-appointed commissioner. And you have to remember that from the 1940s through the end of the 1970s, both political parties in this country agreed that strong antitrust law was important for making our economic system work. And so it was really shocking to these commissioners when Reagan appointees came in and, you know, did what you would expect if you want to make an agency ineffective. Dramatically cut the budget, cut the staff, got rid of whole departments, fired a lot of the lawyers, and I think most importantly, narrowed the definition of what an antitrust violation is. And every administration since then has been afraid to really make even the weak antitrust provisions that are in law to actually enforce them, all administrations. So this had the effect that you might expect. What happens when companies are allowed to get as big as they want? And you know, we've had a flurry of mergers and acquisitions beginning in the 70s, but then into the 80s, into the 90s, continuing today. And probably no industry has been as affected as food and agribusiness, where we have such a few players in every aspect of it that control the industry. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes when we're kind of done with this historical overview. So this began to shift political power and to change elections. This is when we really began to see the push to make elections, I mean, I'm going to say it as it is, kind of for sale. So we have this system of legalized bribery today where whoever can raise the most money basically in most elections wins. And that really began during that period of the 1980s going into the 1990s. Now, with the growing influence of corporations and the desire to get bigger, to have more control, and to have an international scope, we began to see the pressure for the trade agreements that have done so much to change our society and our food system. There were, when we're talking about the food industry, some companies that had a really brilliant strategy about how to get a hold of these negotiations and to benefit from them. And so when the Clinton administration came into office, they were very enthusiastic about these trade agreements. And some companies, like Cargill, began to put together a strategy that was, like I said, pretty smart. Now, in the past, food-related companies and agribusiness had a really difficult time in speaking with one voice. You know, everybody was interested in kind of their parochial part of the business and a lot of arguing amongst themselves. So Cargill put together a coalition of 100 different companies to sit down and between themselves in private to debate what kind of trade policy would be most beneficial to all of them and what they could agree upon so that they could speak with one voice in this very controversial debate over trade. But really, it, a lot of these discussions aren't about tariffs, because that's what traditionally trade has been about, tariffs. This was really about supplanting a lot of the sovereignty of nations in determining health, environmental, and safety rules. And so their strategy worked. And as far as the agreement on agriculture under the World Trade Organization, Cargill pretty much wrote those policies. And the U.S., of course, with the support of the Clinton administration, was able to force first NAFTA, North America Free Trade Agreement, through Congress, and then the membership in the World Trade Organization. You know, this is a very undemocratic process. It's called fast track. So the president has the authority to do the negotiation, and when it goes to Congress, Congress people have to vote it up or down, and this is called fast track. And it's this type of trade votes has been going on since the Nixon administration. So, of course, the U.S. did become a party to these trade agreements. And this meant, as far as food production goes, that a lot of food production could be outsourced, because the real goal was being able to produce food where it's cheapest, where labor is cheapest, and where, let's face it, environmental laws, regulation is not as strict. So, I mean, we can look at the effects of that today just in fruits and vegetables. Today, 50% of fruits are grown overseas, 20 to 30% of vegetables, depending on the year. And we hear about the purported benefits in the developing world, but if you really study what's happened there, we see that peasant farmers get pushed off the land, big corporations move in, food is produced for export, and it's nothing about feeding people in those countries, and it's created a super rich in many of those countries, you know, like we are created or have created here in the United States. So these trade agreements were a major change in how food is produced. And the same companies began to pressure Congress to write a farm bill that would get farm policy completely in line with trade policy. Now, those New Deal programs that I mentioned earlier had continued to be chipped away, but some of the programs still existed. We still had a grain reserve. Actually, the grain reserve used to make money. And the USDA still had some oversight of supply management. There was a lot of acreage that was taken out of production. I mean, there were still things that were really the last vestiges of those New Deal programs that were still helping to stabilize prices at least somewhat. So industry, the same economic interests that were lobbying for the WTO, got together and wrote a bill. They called it Freedom to Farm. Now tell me, any time that the word freedom is attached to a piece of legislation, what does it usually mean? So very soon, farmers were calling this legislation Freedom to Fail, because what it did is it took away any of the policies that were in place that kept the overproduction of commodities from happening. Now, who might want overproduction of commodities? Well, let's think about who benefits. Grain traders like overproduction of commodities. Food processors like overproduction of commodities, which means cheap prices. The soda industry likes to have access to cheap commodities. The meat industry likes cheap feed. So these are the main economic interests that really pressed for these changes. And within 2 years, the price of corn had dropped 50%. The price of soy had dropped 40%. And rural areas, the Corn Belt, Iowa, a lot of other states, were really suffering because of the low commodity prices. And there was a lot of pressure on Congress to do something that eventually resulted in some subsidy programs that really the main beneficiaries of those, I would say, are the big companies who get those cheap commodities. Let's talk a little bit about some of those companies that benefited. Well, you know, Iowa used to be a hog state, right? Everybody knows that Iowa used to be, and still is, a hog producer, but there used to be a lot of family farms in Iowa, diversified farms that produced hogs and you know, other crops as well. They grew their own feed, may have had a small dairy. And a lot of these diversified farms were, you know, making a living when there were a lot of meat packers that they could kind of let compete to buy their animals. Because, you know, if you don't have four or five meat packers to go to, if you only have one meat packer or even two, then how are you going to get a fair price? Well, what began to happen after the consolidation in the industry, in the meat industry? I mean, that's been a very sad story for a state like Iowa. The consolidation began in the end of the 1980s, but really into the 1990s under the Clinton administration. And I said I'm going to pick on both political parties. I would say that Bill Clinton's policies about consolidation were some of the worst that we've ever seen in the history of this country. And a lot of the consolidation that happened in the hog industry and in the food industry began under the Clinton administration. In 1997, 30% of hogs were raised on factory farms. After the 1996 Farm Bill and the cheap grains, that meant that the amount of grain that a farmer grew no longer limited the amount of animals. And in fact, to be able to stay in business, they had to have very large hog operations. Well, by 2004, 80% of hogs were raised on factory-style farms, confined animal feeding operations. By 2007, the last time the USDA really looked at these numbers, 95% of hogs nationally, I'm talking nationally, not in Iowa, were raised on factory farms. And the reason is the consolidation that allowed the meatpacking industry to become so consolidated, and then the cheap grains. Now, some other things happened under the Clinton administration that I want to mention, because I think they've had a very dramatic effect on our food system and our political system. And really, to fix our food system, I think we have to fix our political system. I think that if we look at what happened to the media at that time, and some of you are old enough to remember this. Now, the media consolidation had just begun in the 1980s. But when the Clinton administration came into office, I believe that was 92, there were 50 large media corporations in the country still. After the Clinton administration left office at the end of their tenure, there were 5 media companies that were left in this country. So we have media companies that have very tight relationships and ownership relationships with some of the major corporations in the country. And when you look at the boards of directors of all of these, of the largest companies, whether it's the financial services industry, whether it's the food industry, whether it's fossil fuels, they're all interlocking boards of directors where you have a lot of the same people who are on the same boards and, you know, who are making a lot of the decisions. And again, I don't think this is a conspiracy. I think this is how people operate and how companies with influential people actually coordinate. So I think this kind of takeover of our media isn't very much discussed today. And I think it's one of the most important factors when we look at our kind of anemic political system, and certainly when we look at our food system. So what's ended up happening with our food system because of all of this consolidation? Well, today we have 20 food processing companies that control 60% of the brands on the grocery store shelves. And if you don't have a copy of Foodopoly, you can go to the Foodopoly website, foodopoly.org, and look at the charts from the book and look at how few companies control many of your favorite brands, including the organic brands. I'll just name the top 5. PepsiCo, which owns dozens of mostly junk food, snack food, salty snacks. Nestle, Kraft, Tyson, the giant meat company, and JBS, the giant Brazilian meat company. And as I've told students earlier today, JBS and Tyson are kind of in a sick race to the finish to see who can be the biggest meat company in the world. And right now, JBS is winning. But, you know, they keep buying other companies in other countries. And really, we have very few companies that are controlling the way that that meat is produced. But even as powerful as these 20 food companies are, they are not the top dogs in the food heap. Today, the real driver in consolidation and the driver for low prices and a lot of the policy decisions about food are being made by the grocery industry. And I know that usually people don't think of the grocery industry, but, you know, if you do your research, there's actually a large body of evidence that points to how much influence the grocery industry has on food production. And no company is more powerful in the food grocery industry than Walmart. Today, one out of three grocery dollars are spent at Walmart, and the Walmart heirs have as much wealth as the bottom 40% of Americans. And to me, that's the metaphor for what's happened to our economic system. You know, an economic system that's supposed to be built on competition, right? But where all public policy is driving companies to get larger and larger. And, you know, I think no segment of the country has been more affected than rural communities by this drive towards consolidation. And I would bet you that most of you who are taking courses in the agricultural departments here aren't taking courses on the impacts of consolidation.
You're listening to Winona Hawter of Food and Water Watch, who lectured on the ISU campus back in October.
So, how does the grocery industry have so much influence? Well, let's just take a big company like Walmart, because really all of the other players in the grocery industry, in fact, all of the big box stores, not just in groceries, but, you know, it could be Lowe's in hardware, they're all following this strategy. If we're talking about food, Walmart has figured out how to suck the profit up from the ground through the distribution and supply channel into their own coffers. And, you know, like so many of these industries, they've been really good strategists. And they need tremendous volume, right? Walmart needs 1 billion pounds of beef every year. They don't want to deal with even 10 different meat packers. They want to deal with a couple of meat packers. They insist on high volume discounts and lower prices every year. And they drive their suppliers to keep figuring out ways to bring their products to market at a cheaper and cheaper price. If you're a PepsiCo or even a Nestle in the United States, Walmart is a really important piece of your business. Walmart has other choices, though, and where it can get junk food. They're kind of in the catbird seat, and they require companies to sign a contract that's not up for negotiation. Processors, and I'm talking about the biggest suppliers in the country, aren't able to negotiate the kind of packaging or even a lot of the ingredients today of their products. Someone who's providing a product for Walmart has to follow it from the field or the manufacturing plant all the way to shelving it at the store. If there is any kind of disruption in getting that product on the shelf, the company gets fined. Companies, suppliers are required to use the data systems that Walmart requires, the logistics systems. The largest companies have to invest in radio frequency tags to track their products. I mean, there are a lot of ways that these very, very large companies are squeezing, you know, basically the profit out of the distribution chain. And we all know who suffers the most, right? In food production, it's going to be the farmers who suffer the most. And we also know that for farmers today, the cost of farming is going way up, right? The cost of seeds. You know, I haven't talked a lot about the seed industry, because I know how controversial it is here with the World Food Prize. But, you know, we basically have three giant seed companies, Monsanto, DuPont, and Syngenta, that control overall in the world about 50% of seeds. The price of seeds is going up dramatically. No matter how you feel about GMOs, the control, the economic control of our most important life-giving seeds is in the hands of a few companies that control the price. And I think just this year in the growing season, there was about a 10% rise in the cost of seeds. And let's face it, when we were talking about the oversupply of commodities, who benefits from the growing commodities. Well, let's talk about the seed companies that sell the chemicals and the seeds. You know, they're some of the biggest beneficiaries of these policies. So, you know, when the grocery industry puts on the squeeze, who gets hurt the most? Well, it's going to be people in the first part of the supply chain. And it's not just the commodity growers, because in writing Foodopoly, I wanted to kind of understand how fruits and vegetables get to market. So I went to the Central Valley of California, because, you know, we always traditionally think that, you know, that's where most of our fruits and vegetables are being grown today, because they have great weather and they have subsidized water, where they've stolen the water from the northern part of the state and piped it to the Central Valley of California. And what I learned is that even these large, like 1,000-acre farms, that's not big enough. Today, the pressure from the consolidated grocery industry is making farms have to become much, much larger. I'm talking about, you know, 10,000 acres and more, depending on what crop we're talking about. And the most influential sector in the Central Valley are the shipper and packers, who now have a relationship with a lot of the largest growers, and they're heavily capitalized, often by hedge funds. And they have to build a lot of infrastructure, including large warehouses at airports. They have to have a relationship, either contractual or ownership relationship, with companies overseas. Because for Walmart, you know, it's not about seasonality, even though we hear a lot about fruits and vegetables coming to market because they're in season. Well, a lot of times it's where they can be produced the cheapest. So these relationships make it possible to procure these fruits and vegetables at the cheapest price, you know, depending on where that is during any particular year. So it's also had a very chilling effect on how fruits and vegetables come to market. Now, another one of the reasons that I wrote Foodopoly was a lot of times, and I'm not sure if it's true here, but a lot of times in places where I go and talk about the book, people really feel like, well, the way we're really going to get out of this mess that we're in isn't by politics, or, you know, that's all hopeless. The only way we're going to really get out of this mess is to grow our food locally, and, you know, we're going to build a food system from the ground up. Now, I am not dissing local food. I mean, I have a farm. We're lucky. We have a good-sized CSA. But, you know, only one-third of farms are near a large urban marketplace. And even in the Washington area and the New York area, as more people are getting into direct sales, we're seeing the market shrink, because there are only so many farmers markets. There are only so many people who are going to take their time to go and pick up a basket of local produce, or who actually have the time to cook the produce or to experiment with the different foods that are in season in that locality. So I think that the local food movement is fantastic. It's great for education. It's great for the farmers and consumers that benefit from it. But I don't think we're going to change the systemic problems with our food system through just local production. There are going to need to be a lot of policy changes to re-regionalize food production. And that means a lot of political changes, right? Because we know how to do these things. We have a lot of the information. We know climate change is going to put increasing pressure on producing food. We just don't have the political will to do what is necessary to really change those policies. And that's the real reason I wrote Foodopoly. I wanted to make the case that we actually need to get involved in politics. And all of you young people in particular have a really important role in the future if we're really going to have a democracy. And if we really want to change these overwhelming problems in our food system, and I don't just mean the way food is produced or the fact that the food industry has had so much influence on a lot of the rules and regulations about how food is produced, and you know, even the fact that the processed food industry can use a recipe of fat, sugar, and salt to addict people to processed food, which isn't good for them. If we're really going to change these things, we're going to have to create the political will to do so. And that's going to take getting involved in politics and really bringing these changes from the community up through the state legislatures and eventually trying to get a better Congress that isn't so dysfunctional. Now, there's one last thing that I want to talk about. You know, I'm at a major university, and I've been talking to students today. And, you know, I know at lots of universities around the nation, there is real pressure on academic freedom. The freedom for professors and for students to actually be able to promote the policies that they believe are best and to get involved in civic affairs. Now, I think it's kind of ironic, and you know, I'm probably going to really be stepping out on a limb here, and maybe people will throw eggs at me, I don't know. But I, you know, in a state like Iowa, you know, farmers, all of these rural communities, farmers are barely making a living. I mean, let's face it. A mid-sized farmer in the United States that makes sales between $100,000 and $250,000, that's what USDA says is a mid-sized farm, they make on average $19,300 a year, and part of that's from a government subsidy. Now, is that really fair for all of the work that farmers do to have somebody have an off-farm job? I mean, there's something wrong with an agricultural system, a food system that doesn't allow farmers to make a decent living. And so, I have kind of a challenge for folks here. I mean, this is a university where a lot of the largest and most powerful agribusiness companies have named wings of different buildings, and where there's a lot of pressure basically on students, I think, not to maybe look into a lot of the deeper problems with the food system. That's what I've heard today. And, you know, I think it's really important that there be academic freedom on university campuses, that students are encouraged, even if they're going to be scientists, to be active participants in democracy and civic affairs. I mean, think about it. Until the 1980s, it was almost unheard of for a professor in science to develop something and then get a patent on it and have a company and maintain a position at a university and have a position at a company. So today, people are being told at universities that it's inappropriate to take a position on the most important issues of the day, but it's okay for professors and the leadership of the university to be on corporate boards and to be profiting from, you know, a number of the economic interests of the companies that they are involved with. So I'm just posing this as kind of a challenge or a question to, you know, talk about it with your friends and people you trust, because, you know, I think that there's something wrong with public policy being for sale, just like there's something wrong with politics being for sale. We need a public space where the economic interests of companies isn't put above the economic interests of people. And I think the university is that kind of space. And I think that the fact that Iowa farmers can't make a living under the regime of a lot of agribusiness companies that are so influential in this university, that there's something shameful about that. That the conventional farmers in the state, I'm not talking about organic farmers, conventional farmers are struggling so hard in Iowa and many other states. So I said I was going to be a little provocative.
That's all we had time for today. This has been Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. I edited the lecture to fit our 55-minute format. The website for Winona Hodder's book is foodopoly.org. You can find a link to it on our website, khoifm.org. Rick Morrison engineered this show, and our theme music was The Fisherman by Leo Kottke. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.